This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, we revisit the Hong Kong protests that have riveted and inspired a world where democracy seems in retreat and autocrats are on the rise. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. It's been more than 100 days since pro-democracy protests began in Hong Kong in early June. They began as a movement against an extradition bill, which would have let criminal suspects in Hong Kong be handed over for trial by Communist Party-controlled courts in mainland China, but have evolved into a larger, broad-based movement for freedom and democracy, commensurate with the financial center's partial autonomy embodied in the one country, two systems model. The British handed Hong Kong back to China in 1997. It is now 22 years into what was supposed to be a 50-year grace period. Under the Sino-British Joint Declaration signed in 1984, Hong Kong is supposed to retain its way of life and freedoms until 2047. However, the protests, now in their 15th straight week, have been largely peaceful and broad-based. Men, women, young and old, have demonstrated that Hong Kongers are resisting any efforts to move up the clock. So where is the courageous but essentially leaderless movement heading? In recent days, Hong Kong democracy activists presented their case before a congressional commission seeking tougher U.S. action, including possible sanctions to counter China's steady erosion of the territory's freedoms. Veteran activist Joshua Wong has raised the alarm over alleged police brutality and China's efforts to erode the one country, two systems framework under which Hong Kong is supposed to enjoy a high level of autonomy. Well, joining us to evaluate the status and implications of the Hong Kong protests are two distinguished regional analysts. Ashley Feng is a research associate for the Energy, Economics, and Security Program at CNAS. That's the Center for a New American Security. She focuses on East Asia and China. And Matt Schrader, he's a China analyst at the Alliance for Securing Democracy at the German Marshall Fund of the United States. And both panelists join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having us on.
Yeah, it's good to be here.
Well, Ashley, let me begin with you. We were at the microphones, as I said, in June, talking about that time, you know, Hong Kong Chief Executive Carrie Lam and her willingness to suspend this extradition bill. She has since withdrawn the bill, which was one of the many demands of the protesters. But that's still not enough. It's sort of too little, too late. Other demands have arisen. I'd like to get your take on the protests thus far, how far they've gone, their significance, and what do you make of these additional demands?
So I think the extradition bill was just a culmination of what you've seen over the past few years coming out of Beijing. So starting in 2016, when you had Beijing force two lawmakers, and since then more subsequent lawmakers out of the LegCo, out of the Legislative Council, which is Hong Kong's legislative body, you've seen more erosions of freedom. And at this point in time, it's not just the extradition bill. The extradition bill symbolizes this larger movement towards Beijing suppressing Hong Kong's basic freedoms that are supposed to be allowed until 2047. And so it's understandable why the protesters have additional demands to ensure that they can still have these freedoms until 2047. I think what you're seeing, though, is this disagreement between whether or not these basic freedoms should be ensured during this period of time, especially as Beijing is trying to increase its presence on the world stage. Hong Kong, as an autonomous region that's part of China, if Beijing cannot quell what it sees as its own protests at home, what does that mean for its global leadership abroad as well?
Thanks for emphasizing and clarifying what's at stake. Turning to you now, Matt Schrader, for your take on where the protests stand thus far. And of course, we have to remind our listeners that Hong Kong Chief Executive Carrie Lam is pretty much a puppet, one could say, of the Beijing government. And one of the demands of the protesters is that they are able to vote for their leaders directly. So your take on where things stand at this point?
Where things stand in terms of where they're going to be going, or which particular aspect of that?
Well, insofar as how you think they've evolved, and also China's continuing efforts to crack down with their threats, their right. mischaracterization right. of the protesters as somehow terrorists and being, you know, manipulated by foreign forces. It's a foreign plot. When we all know this is an indigenous movement. These are protesters, broad-based, men, women, young and old, who have come out in droves on the streets, mostly peacefully. And so where do you see things going?
One thing that I think is getting lost a little bit in a lot of the conversation around the protests, even in Western analysis, even in quite friendly pro-democracy Western analysis, is some of the political history over the past 20 or 30 years between Hong Kong and China. Because we kind of check back in on this situation once every 5 years or so when something big flares up, and we're not experiencing this the way the people on the ground are, which is there's been a long history, actually, of broken promises on Beijing's side to move the territory towards actual greater autonomy and self-government. There were a couple of occasions quite soon after the handover in 1997 when Beijing actually promised that full suffrage would be implemented for the territory, that they'd be able to vote directly for the chief executive, which currently is appointed by a body that's more or less named by Beijing. And there were actually deadlines set for the date that full suffrage would arrive. And those deadlines were pushed back by Beijing a couple of times. And that's one of the things that touched off the huge umbrella protest movement in 2014, was that Beijing offered the protesters a version of full suffrage, what they called full suffrage, that wasn't full suffrage. It was not going to be people directly voting for the chief executive. And that's why you had people taking to the streets in 2014. And obviously, that didn't have the result that they were looking for in 2014. And not only that, but many of the leaders of those very, very peaceful protests, and I went there, I saw it myself, they were unbelievably peaceful and well-organized. Many of the leaders of these peaceful democratic protests were eventually imprisoned, were in some cases forced out of their job or forced into early retirement. Beijing's controls over the city's media and over other levers of power were actually deepened and strengthened. Now we're at a point where there are some people who are saying protesters should have taken the deal in 2014, or they need to find a way to find a middle ground with Beijing at this point. And I don't think people who are putting that argument out are really taking into account this history of promises for democracy being made that weren't kept. And that's in the minds of all these protesters, that something was promised, they didn't get it, and is the other side a good faith interlocutor? Is there any alternative other than taking to the streets?
And back to you, Ashley, to talk about these protests and underscore what really is at stake. China does seem to be reneging on its agreement, and these young people and older people, many of whom look with great admiration to the younger ones who are taking up the mantle, are very much in favor of pushing the envelope, so to speak. On the other hand, there are some hardliners in the movement, and even if one can understand their resort to violence in reaction to police brutality by the Hong Kong security forces, to what extent do some of these hardliners who do use violence, to what extent do you think they mar the efforts of the overall movement?
In this case, I do not believe that they should have to resort to violence. I would say, however, in this case specifically, though, what you saw first was an action on behalf of the Hong Kong police to protect the protesters from the triads and different gangsters that were attacking protesters for peaceful protesting. They were expressing their points of view, and then out of seemingly nowhere, there were a bunch of gangsters and triads who are aligned with the more pro-Beijing movement who then went after them. And I think in self-defense, what then you had were a lot of protesters responding to that. But I think because of that spark of violence at the beginning and the lack of rule of law in this case, which was supposed to be the police force protecting the protesters who had gotten permission to protest in the first place, I think that sparked off this escalation of violence that is just really hard to control right now from either side.
Well, that's an excellent explanation of the sequence of events. Well, back to you, Matt Schrader, because I want to ask you about these other conditions the protesters are presenting that right. need to be addressed.
Right.
So the extradition bill was withdrawn. That was the minimum that was required. But what
I should point out that it hasn't actually been withdrawn. Carrie Lam has just said that when LegCo comes back into session, she will table a motion to withdraw it. But that has not actually taken place.
Okay. Well, what about the inquiry into allegations of police brutality amnesty for arrested protesters and other electoral reforms. Do you have any sense of optimism that these will be addressed? And are these reasonable demands in your view?
Yes. I think it's reasonable in a territory that is nominally supposed to be governed by a kind of rule of law where the government is supposed to be accountable and transparent to its people. In instances of sustained and widespread police brutality against peaceful protesters, which there is overwhelming documentary evidence that this is what we've seen, that there has to be some kind of accountability for that sort of behavior. And the citizens of Hong Kong, if they want to be able to trust their police force, which had a reputation in years past as one of the greatest in Asia, that it's reasonable to ask that there's an independent inquiry, a truly independent inquiry into this sort of behavior. Likewise, I think demands for greater democratization and amnesty for peaceful protesters are also reasonable demands. And so these people want more democracy, they want more transparency, and I think they're making a fairly reasonable set of demands upon their government, in some cases just to live up to pre-existing commitments that came both from it and from Beijing.
We'll have more in just a moment, but first, you're listening to Encounter on The Voice of America. Our guests are Ashley Feng. She's a research associate for the Energy, Economics, and Security Program, focusing on China and East Asia at the Center for a New American Security, and Matt Schrader, from whom you just heard. He's a China analyst with the Alliance for Securing Democracy at the German Marshall Fund of the United States here in Washington. We're discussing the implications of the continuing pro-democracy protests in Hong Kong, given Beijing's relentless crackdown. And this is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. Well, here's a shout out to a loyal listener, Comrade Cyprian Emeko Okolo from Anambra State in Nigeria. If you want to hear your name on the air and home country, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to our discussion now, and let me turn to Ashley Feng. Ashley, let's take a look at the economic aspects of all of this. I mean, this is a major global financial center, Hong Kong. There's no way that it has not been suffering as a result of the protests, the stoppage of the airlines, the airport for several days was shut down. Business people are having difficulties. So talk about the impact and how detrimental this may be.
We've actually heard from a couple business people on the ground that they have canceled all foreseeable travel, which is hard because Hong Kong is supposed to be this huge financial center for all of Asia. But in order to conduct business in Asia, you have to go elsewhere. By not being able to do so with the shutdown of the airports, you are automatically harming the economy. I think something else that is important to remember about Hong Kong, though, also from the economic side, is that it's also the biggest destination of Chinese foreign direct investment. And I think that it's also important that as part of that statistic, a lot of that is also money that's coming from the Chinese Communist Party elites and other business people that are associated with the CCP. They pour their money into Hong Kong so that they can then push it elsewhere in the world. So I think that when you look at the economics aspect of Hong Kong, you just can't look at it from a purely business perspective. You also have to look at it as a tool of not just the CCP, but people affiliated with the CCP that then want to go elsewhere and invest in other places around the world.
Matt Schrader, if in fact the CCP and Chinese business people and others have such a stake in Hong Kong, isn't it somehow counterproductive for them to be cracking down on these protesters, on the movement? Doesn't it actually hurt them? And they seem to be worried about something, which is the right of Hong Kong under its semi-autonomous status to enjoy a certain degree of political and economic freedom.
That's the $64 billion question, is why have we not seen a more vigorous crackdown from Beijing? Almost since the start of the protests, Beijing's made pretty clear that it's going to keep its options open as far as more forceful. There's actually a sports stadium in a city across the bay from Hong Kong called Shenzhen. That stadium has been full of armored police vehicles almost since the start of the protest. And the really clear message to protesters is, we're not going to do this now, but we have this option in reserve if you really push us, if you really make Hong Kong ungovernable and we have to assert order in the city through other means. But that's absolutely going to be a last resort for Beijing. And
because they have too much at stake, economically at least.
So they have too much at stake economically because of its importance to China's economy and because of its importance to China's political elite, because of its importance to political patronage networks inside of China. So that's the one side. But another reason is because they have a lot of tools that they can use to address these protests short of a Tiananmen-style roll-the-tanks-in crackdown. The Hong Kong government has been front and center in the response to the protests. So the central government has very much said, this is your problem, you're out in front on this, it's your responsibility, you're also going to be the fall guy if something goes wrong. So that's one aspect of the response. But another aspect is what we call, people who study PRC politics, we call United Front style mobilization. Basically, United Front, it's a term for how the Communist Party gets societal elites to go along with its agenda inside of China. So it's about how do you co-opt business groups, how do you co-opt universities, how do you co-opt media, how do you co-opt religious figures, and make sure that all these people are participating in the authoritarian system that the party has constructed. Not just sort of neutrally, passively being there, but actually helping to reproduce this system. And Beijing has sunk a lot of effort into this kind of United Front style mobilization in Hong Kong since 1997, basically co-opting business elites, particularly real estate developers who are very politically powerful inside of Hong Kong and who now have large businesses in the mainland, elite finance figures, Chinese banks are increasingly present in the city, educational figures, the city's major universities are now in most cases run by people that were named with the tacit consent of Beijing. And so another really important lever besides the Hong Kong government itself has been Beijing saying to Hong Kong societal elites, you need to get your city in line because otherwise all of the business and all of the relationships that you've established in the mainland may no longer be available to you. And the prosperity and the power that you derive from that may no longer be available to you if you don't do the job we expect of you as elites within this system.
Matt put it perfectly, and how important Hong Kong is to the CCP elite. But something else that's really important is how Hong Kong is classified by other economies. So you have a lot of other economies, including the United States, that classifies Hong Kong as a separate economic area from the mainland. And so therefore, what Hong Kong can do, and why I think there's so much FDI into Hong Kong and
foreign direct investment
into Hong Kong and outside of Hong Kong is because that way CCP officials and other elites can get things that they cannot get in the mainland because those are blocked by export controls multilaterally and unilaterally.
Well, that's fascinating, but I want to continue on as we close. It's kind of hard to understand what the U.S. policy is toward Hong Kong, Ashley, because we sort of had different voices. You have bipartisan agreement in the Congress, very much backing the Hong Kong protests, the democracy elements, and the need to keep the autonomy as it is now, and even the State Department. But sometimes we hear other things from the Trump administration saying, well, this isn't any of our business, the protesters, et cetera. How do you reconcile what's going on vis-a-vis U.S. policy? And do you think that the recent appeal to the Congress on behalf of Hong Kong activists asking them for greater support, what are the chances of anything in that regard, such as the Hong Kong Human Rights Democracy Act?
So I think there have always been policy divergences between what Congress wants and what the executive branch wants. And I think in this case, it's been, from what you're hearing coming out of Congress specifically, the Congressional Executive Commission on China, which spotlights a lot of these different issues from Nancy Pelosi's office, from Senator Marco Rubio's office, that based on the signals that the protesters are getting because of how much support has been coming out of Congress, I think that it is natural for them to gravitate more towards congressional action. And because Congress does have the ability to legislate, we've also seen reports coming out of Congress over the past few weeks or so indicating that they do want to pass this act, which does carry some economic consequences for Beijing that they hope will then further deter Beijing from taking any drastic actions. And I think in that case, it's smart for the protesters to go where they think they will get the most support and the most actual actions.
So what is your take on that, Matt Schrader, with regard to the U.S. role? How could it be
productive? Can we make a difference, or other Western powers, in your view? We're looking at this, you know, courageous movement, but against a behemoth, hegemonic, autocratic regime.
That's a fantastic question. I think that's the question that really kind of gets at the heart of some of the debate on how we handle this in the United States is, can we even really make a difference? You know, are we just doing this to make ourselves feel good? I think actually in this case, it would behoove us to listen to the activists themselves. Listen to the people who are coming to the United States, who are leading this fight for democracy and democratic freedoms, who tell us that action on our part would be helpful. Action on our part would give them space and voice in their own society and could help relieve some of the pressure coming from Beijing. I don't think it's wise for us to tie our hands by saying that, you know, we don't have any leverage in this fight.
If we did that, Ashley, would that in any way undermine the U.S. position vis-a-vis trade talks with China? Would China somehow use that against the United States?
I think China has a tendency to group all of these issues together, but as a matter of policy, the United States has individual policy stances, whether it's the trade talks, whether it's the Hong Kong protests, whether it's what's happening in Xinjiang, all of these things, the United States has policy actions, and Beijing's attempts to tie all of this together in order to tie the United States' hands, we shouldn't let that happen because it's our policy. So I really think that there should be a multilateral approach to this in which you have international condemnation of what Beijing is doing in Hong Kong, because the handing over of Hong Kong back to China was part of international law in the first place. And the international community, they should do it because to uphold the norms of international law. If you want the application of international law and rule of law to stay relevant, then an international condemnation for China saying, making remarks that the handover, that the agreement that they signed with Britain was no longer applicable in this case, that's an outright violation of that agreed norm and international law in general.
And so you get the last word, Matt, with regard to where do you think this is heading, the movement? Because right now, this movement is the most inspiring movement probably in the world as we see the tendency toward pessimism and autocracy and nativism. And here's a movement waving the American flag, singing the, you know, U.S. national anthem on the streets, looking toward the United States in particular for support for their movement. And they're not asking for anything more than what the basic law and the agreement between China and the British was to retain a certain degree of autonomy.
If you were to put a gun to my head and say, what do you think is the most likely thing to happen over the next year, two, 3 years, I probably would bet on just kind of a festering of the current situation, that nothing really gets resolved, that you probably see continuing low-level street protests and continuing efforts by Beijing to sort of choke them off by exerting pressure both through the Hong Kong government and through Hong Kong societal elites. And that probably will turn into kind of a game of cat and mouse where protesters are trying to get their voices heard, trying to disobey civilly. And the government is trying to bring the city back completely under control. That being said, I don't think from a policy perspective it necessarily makes sense just to think in terms of the next year or two or 3 years, or even like even the likelihood of the protesters succeeding in getting what they want in terms of democratic reforms. If we were thinking in terms of, is it rational to support L'Equilessa and Solidarity in the early 1980s or the mid-1980s.
In Poland.
Yeah, in Poland. The man who eventually ended up leading the labor movements that would bring down, that were critical in bringing down the Soviet Union. You know, if we'd been looking at the situation, quote unquote, rationally in the early 80s, we would have thought, well, this man has the entire might of the Soviet state arrayed against him. Why should we support this guy? What leverage do we have? We did it because we thought that was the right thing to do, and we think democracy is important. And we may not see necessarily how that's going to pay off immediately, but we have to stand by those principles because that's what we are as a country.
Well, on that eloquent and optimistic note, I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition, but we will be following the Hong Kong protests and bringing you the latest in the weeks and months ahead. I'd like to thank my guests, Ashley Feng. She's Research Associate for the Energy, Economics, and Security Program at the Center for a New American Security, and Matt Schrader with the Alliance for Securing Democracy at the German Marshall Fund. Thank you both for a lively and informative conversation. Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Kim Lewis for booking our guests. Our engineer was Aidan Utko. And I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter.
on The Voice of America.